KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Afghan-born American writer Khaled Hosseini's first novel, The Kite Runner, electrified readers with its intimate images of life in Afghanistan. Hosseini's just published his third novel. It's a return to Afghanistan. Khaled Hosseini will be our guest later this hour. Army Staff Sergeant Robert Bales is set to give his own account of what happened the evening that 16 Afghan civilians, mostly women and children, were murdered last year. Bales is accused of those killings, but he has yet to testify under oath. He's expected to confess in exchange for life in prison rather than the death penalty. Gene Johnson has been covering this story for the Associated Press. He joined me earlier this morning from Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and I asked him more specifically what Robert Bales is expected to do today.
Today he's expected to plead guilty to 16 counts of premeditated murder, as well as other charges stemming from this raid on two villages in southern Afghanistan in March 2012. Prosecutors say he left the remote base where he was stationed in the middle of the night, went out, attacked one village, returned to the base, woke up another soldier, confessed what he did. The soldier didn't believe him, said, you're full of it, went back to sleep. Bales left again, attacked another village, and then returned early in the morning to the base, soaked in blood.
This is the first time that Bales is actually going to testify to this under oath?
Correct. He hasn't given any public statements. His lawyers initially said that he didn't really remember what happened that night, that his memory was hazy. But when, he's faced with the death penalty, or prosecutors anyway, were seeking the death penalty, and he started remembering more about what he did, according to his lawyers, as more evidence and more statements from the victims emerged. And today in court, the judge is expected to question Bales closely about what he did that night. This is part of the judge's process in deciding whether to accept this guilty plea. He has to check and make sure he believes what Bales is saying.
Now, this is a military court, correct?
It is. It's a courtroom down at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It's in a brick building. Security is extremely tight. They're really concerned about just making sure this process goes on as it's supposed to.
As it was being reported this week that today's testimony, which is essentially I did it, a guilty plea, was part of an official plea deal. But then I've read conflicting accounts that say, well, it's not a done deal, that the military court does not have to accept this or count it as a deal to get him out of the death penalty.
Well, it is a plea deal. The plea deal has been agreed to by the defense and the prosecution, and it has been approved by the commanding general at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, who is the convening authority for the court-martial here. It is true that the judge has to sign off on it, and that's part of what today's hearing is about, is making sure that everything is up to snuff as far as bail of admission goes, that the judge believes that he did in fact commit these acts that he is claiming to have committed. So it does need the judge's approval, but the plea deal has been agreed to, and as part of that, the military will take the death penalty off the table, and there will be a trial in front of a military jury this summer. It's currently scheduled for August 19th, or to begin August 19th, at which the sides or the jury will determine whether Bales is sentenced to life with the possibility of parole or without it.
But in either case, it's a life sentence. There's no lesser sentence that he could receive for this.
Correct.
And not till August. Where is he being held at this point?
He's being held at Joint Base Lewis-McChord in a military prison.
Now, you mentioned that this jury is going to hear the whole case again in August and determine what the final sentence is. I know that attorney John Henry Brown has said all along that Staff Sergeant Bales is a victim of PTSD, of traumatic head injury, that there are extenuating circumstances. And I believe the quote I heard this morning was that the American people or the military itself has some amount of guilt in this crime. And is that what he's expected to say in August, or does he appear today at all to say things like that?
Certainly that is what the defense is going to argue in August. And John Henry Brown has said that all along. You know, Bales was on his fourth combat deployment. His lawyers say that he had been suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and a concussive head injury that he sustained during a previous deployment in Iraq, and that, you know, basically that he had no business being sent again to Afghanistan. So, yes, John Henry Brown has said that the military should bear some responsibility for this, that you know, Staff Sergeant Bales was not a mass murderer on his first deployment. And, you know, the effects of these repeated deployments on the troops can be severe. And that's the argument that they're going to hope to make, or that they are going to make in August, in hopes of securing a sentence of life with the possibility of parole.
Just a last question has to do more widely, I suppose, with the military and response to many soldiers. This is the worst single crime that we've heard about coming out of Afghanistan, but it's certainly not the only instance we've heard of troops coming back, either committing suicide, having some sort of mental illness that's related to their service. And how does this trial, do you suppose, impact how we view the aftermath of war?
You know, I don't know that it. I don't know how much it impacts it. You know, certainly, it's been an issue in previous wars with troops coming home. I think it does put the focus on it. I've talked with John Henry Brown, Bales' attorney, about this, and you know, he's actually a little bit disappointed. He thought that the case would have done more to focus attention on these issues, and he doesn't believe it's done enough, and he's disappointed that the U.S. is still in Afghanistan. You know, there is maybe one other aspect that we should talk about, and that is that we have spoken with several survivors or relatives of relatives of survivors of this massacre, and you know, they're outraged that Bales is going to apparently escape the death penalty for this. I mean, obviously, there's a different code of justice in Afghanistan, but a lot of the villagers have said that they're very upset about this. Some of them have vowed revenge in interviews with the AP, you know, saying that for this one thing they would kill 100 American soldiers. So this does have some possibility to inflame tensions in Afghanistan.
Gene Johnson is a Seattle-based reporter for the Associated Press. He's at Joint Base Lewis-McChord awaiting Robert Bales' testimony this morning. We're going to hear more about this later today, both from KUOW's Patricia Murphy and NPR's Martin Costi. This is Weekday.
How about those Mariners, huh? Yeah, about that. Why are the Seattle Mariners doing so poorly? Some thoughts on that in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Northwest Traverse Series, featuring two multi-sport relays for solo and teams to include running, paddling, mountain biking, and road biking. The Olympia Traverse on July 27th and the Peace Health Bellingham Traverse on September 21st. Registration at recreationnorthwest.com.
67 degrees in Seattle. Forecast calls for sun today and a high of 78. Khaled Hosseini, best-selling author of The Kite Runner, has a new book out called And the Mountains Echoed. It's the story of an Afghan family torn apart by time and distance. Khaled Hosseini joins us to talk about his work in 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. On a beautiful late spring day, the idea of ducking out of work and heading to a baseball game is so enticing. But these days, you have to be a real fan if you want to go see the Seattle Mariners. For a brief moment earlier this year, it looked like this was going to be the year that the M's got it right. And maybe it still could be, but things really haven't been going the team's way. Joining us to talk about what this means for team leadership is Seattle Times sports reporter Larry Stone. He covers Major League Baseball for the Times, writes the blog Hot Stone League. Hi, Larry. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. How you doing?
I'm good. Let's start with the basics. What did go wrong with the Mariners this season?
Well, I think first and foremost, they had three young and they hoped up and coming players, Dustin Ackley, Justin Smoak, and Jesus Montero, who they were counting on, and none of them has come through to the standard that they were hoping. And two of them are in the minor leagues right now, Montero and Ackley. And I think that's the root of their problems. And then they've had some pitching issues. Beyond their two great pitchers in Felix Hernandez and Hisashi Iwakuma, the rest of the starting staff has been kind of up and down. And that's a pretty good start for why they're seven games under 500.
It looked, though, in spring training they were doing pretty well. Like this was going to be the year they've turned it around. But 5 years ago, general manager Jack Zarensic was hired to do that, to right the sinking ship, and that doesn't seem like that's happened.
Well, I don't think the progress has been what anyone hoped or expected. Jack, as you mentioned, was hired. He inherited a pretty bad situation from his predecessor, Bill Bavese. He went about rebuilding it through drafts, farm system, young players, and for that to work, those players have to come through and produce. And the three guys I mentioned all came at great cost, and so far they were supposed to be sort of the foundation for the next generation, and it hasn't happened yet. So, Jack's done some good things. Some things have not worked out so well, but bottom line in baseball is the win-loss record, and they're headed for the fourth straight losing season. He had a very good first season, but since then it's kind of fallen apart.
Well, that's the general manager. Maybe you can explain the division of responsibility between manager Eric Wedge and general manager Jack Zarensic. Who's responsible for what, and does Wedge have any blame in this?
Well, the general manager's job, just to put it succinctly, it's his job to acquire the players and build the team, and then it's the manager's job to take those players and deploy them and win baseball games. So, the way it works in baseball, the buck stops with the manager. The scapegoat is almost always the manager, because it's the easiest person to change. And there is some heat under Eric Wedge. I tend to think that he's working with what he has, and You know, you can argue with some of the strategic moves that he's made, but I just don't think he's had the talent to do much better than what he's done.
I one of the things that they did this year that was supposed to make things better was move the home run fence in a little bit at Safeco Field. People have complained for years that it's so hard to hit. So as I understand it now, they're hitting more home runs, but they're not scoring more runs in general.
Yeah, well, they are. Their scoring is up. Probably not commensurate to the amount of home runs that they've hit, and they are hitting much better at home than they were. So that aspect of it is successful. But you know, there was some question about, you know, maybe they'd get more home runs but get fewer doubles and triples just because the fences were closer, so there was less room for gap hits, and that seems to kind of have happened, but. Their problem this year has been on the road. They've actually been doing decently at home. So, you know, maybe they fixed that aspect, but, you know, the leaks are springing elsewhere.
I was just imagining one of those whack-a-mole games, and you hit one down and the other one pops up.
Exactly.
We're talking with Seattle Times baseball writer Larry Stone. Another really kind of morbid game that baseball fans like to play here is to watch the great success of former Mariners as soon as they leave Seattle. You know, there's actually just brought Raul Ibanez back because he was doing well in other places. So is it then something about the tone that is being set in the clubhouse? I mean, is there any kind of mental part to this game that we don't see that is causing problems?
Well, yeah, there is. And the phenomenon that you pointed out is definitely real. I mean, this year there's a guy named Mike Karp who the Mariners let go, who's now tearing it up with the Boston Red Sox. Mm-hmm. You know, Mariners did essentially released him. They designated him for assignment in spring training. I don't think anyone could quite put their finger. You could criticize their development staff. Maybe they're not developing players right. Maybe there is some sort of aura or culture here that brings players down. That's what Eric Wedge has kind of put as his number one job, is changing the culture to a winning type culture. And you know, the team has improved. His first year improved on the previous year, and then last year was better. And you know, there's still a chance for this year to be better. It could still be moving in the right direction. So hard to pinpoint what happens, but there definitely is a large catalog of players who have succeeded once they've left Seattle.
Well, let's climb up the ladder a little bit to the front office. Many fans have moved beyond calling for the resignation or firing of Wedge and Zarensic, and they're talking about the CEOs, Howard Lincoln and President Chuck Armstrong's departure. They're calling for their heads, essentially.
Well, you know, in 2002, the Mariners led the major leagues in attendance. They pretty much filled Safeco Field every night, 3.5 million fans. Last year, they had 1.7 million. So essentially, their attendance has been halved over a 10-year period. So, you know, that's an indictment of the organization, I think. Something's gone wrong. Something is awry when half the fan base abandons the team. And I think it's fair to point the finger towards the top, but you know, the Mariners have a different setup than most teams. Their head owner, Hiroshi Yamauchi, the Nintendo founder, is in Japan, has never seen the team play. It's sort of absentee ownership, and there doesn't seem to really be anybody to hold Howard and longtime team president Chuck Armstrong to the fire. So they're both in their 70s, but other than retirement or a change in ownership, it doesn't seem like anything will change there.
There have been some rumors of sale of the team.
There have been, and I mean, I've got to think it's going to happen at some point. Yamauchi, the principal guy, is in his mid-80s, I believe. So, you know, it would be logical. There's some things that have happened. They got this new regional sports network deal going that could be a precursor to a sale, or you know, maybe one of the minority owners will, you know, here in Seattle will buy majority ownership. Those rumors have existed for a few years, staunchly denied by Lincoln. But, you know, I would, it just seems logical that eventually something will happen considering the age of, mm-hmm. of the principal owner.
Why hasn't he ever seen this team play?
Well, he's getting up there in years, and he doesn't travel anymore.
But they went to Japan.
Yeah, and, you know, there was, I believe there were some health issues involved that kept him. But, you know, he was a couple of hours train ride away. You would have thought that he would go see him, but it's an unusual situation. I don't know if there's ever been a case like that in the history of professional sports where the owner has never seen his team play.
I have to ask about something that you've reported on your blog, which is that despite this, it sounds like a 50% decline in attendance, that the Mariners are still turning a profit.
Right.
How
yeah.
is that? Just because they've bumped up the price?
Well, that's part of it, and bumped down the payroll. You know, those two factors lead to profitability.
Are you saying we get what we pay for?
You know, there was a time the Mariners had a payroll of $120 million about 4 or 5 years ago, and they became the first team ever to lose 100 games with a payroll over $100 million, and it's come steadily down since then.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, it's... That aspect of the I'm sure that you people wondering why they're still in office in power. People who run teams like to turn profits, so that aspect they're succeeding.
Yeah, but you also sort of like people to like your team and want to go see them.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, you have to go see him. It's part of your job. And I'm sure there are people listening right now who are just telling me that I'm a fair weather fan. But it's not all that much fun to, even on the most beautiful day, to go to Safeco Field and watch a loss.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been here since 97, and I've just never seen the animosity and negativity towards this team that I, you know, I just hear constantly from people who just are just so down on the Mariners, and you know, that's just not a healthy state for a franchise. And there's really only one solution, and that's they need to start winning baseball games, and suddenly, you know, everybody will soften their feelings. And I do think that I do think it's a passionate and rabid fan base that wants to come back on board. And once they start winning, I think that they'll start filling that place again. You know, people say they'll never come back and all that, but I think once the product is better and you're in pennant races and there's exciting baseball, I think people will come flocking back.
So we need to build up their self-esteem so they think they can win, and then we'll all come back, and then they will be winning, and then maybe Paul Allen, who already has a basketball team and a football team, will want to acquire a baseball team.
And a soccer team, too.
And maybe a hockey team as well, and we can build that arena down in Soto. Larry, thank you. Thanks, and I hope you get to cover some more winning games for the Seattle Mariners.
My pleasure. That would be nice. Thanks.
Seattle Times sports reporter Larry Stone writes about Major League Baseball for the newspaper, and he also writes a blog at the Times called The Hot Stone League, where he covers the Mariners and other baseball goings-on. And as of this morning, the Mariners are 10 games out of first place, and I haven't looked at the percentage, but they are not yet at the 500 mark. This is Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:30. Khaled Hosseini, best-selling author of The Kite Runner, has a new book out. He's here in our studio, and he'll be talking with Marcy in just a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Lottery, supporting the Washington Opportunity Pathways account to help fund higher education scholarships in Washington. More at walottery.com.
Lots of sun in the forecast. Today, sunny. Tomorrow, sunny. Sunny over the weekend, and then at least partly sunny on Monday. Over the next 4 or 5 days, we're expecting daytime highs in the 70s and overnight lows in the 50s.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Farmers and Ranchers. The Washington Grown Project celebrates family-owned and operated farms and ranches, which produce milk, hay, and pears for Washington State and the world. Learn more at wagrown.com.
9:31. I'm Bernard Ouellette. In the news today, U.S. private sector job growth picked up slightly in May, but the 135,000 new jobs fell well short of expectations. That and more of today's news in 30 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. In 2003, 10 years ago, Afghan-born writer Khaled Hosseini burst onto the literary scene with a novel called The Kite Runner. Was a bestseller, and he followed it with another bestseller called A Thousand Splendid Suns. Now Khaled Hosseini is back with a new novel. It begins in Afghanistan, but it takes readers around the world and into the lives of six generations of people. The book is called And the Mountains Echoed. Khaled Hosseini, welcome back to Seattle.
Thank you very much.
This novel is almost a collection of interwoven short stories. Where did you begin in it?
It started with the very the main storyline, which is the love between these two siblings, a boy and his little sister. We meet them first in 1952, and she's 3, he's 10, and they're with their father, and they're crossing a desert, and they're going to Kabul. And something happens in Kabul that alters their lives in a very profound way. And that's where the book began.
I read that you actually had this image, the visual image of the wagon in the desert, right. And you didn't know who was in it or what it was, and you started from that.
Yeah, it was just started with this very vivid picture of this guy walking across the desert, and he's pulling this one of those old radio flyer wagons, and there's a little girl inside, and the boy about 10 years old, and he's walking behind him. And I just have no idea how the image came or what it meant, but it just felt so compelling, and it was something I really wanted to explore. And I just began working with it, and then figured out the relationships and figured out that they were going someplace where something was going to happen, and didn't know what, but just kind of kept figuring it out as I wrote it.
Your previous two novels really focus on the same set of characters, and this structurally is really quite different. As I mentioned, these are interconnected stories. Sometimes they're very interconnected, and sometimes the connection is more tangential.
Right.
And so how did you decide to move in that direction as a writer?
Well, it's the way the book unfolded. I meant initially when I began, I thought I was going to write a straightforward, linear narrative. And as I began writing, I heard all these other voices and all these other characters who really spoke to me and who really appealed to me. And there was simply no way to pack them into sort of this linear structure. And the only way to give each of these characters a chance at telling their perspective was to branch out in different directions. And so write the novel as a series of sort of interconnected, sometimes extremely connected, sometimes the connection is a little bit more tenuous. So there's sort of a shifting perspective, sort of a mosaic, so that each vignette adds to the big picture. So taken together, you sort of walk away with the sense of a big story having been told.
It's more kaleidoscopic than the other books, I suppose. There is the through line that you mentioned. The main characters are this brother and sister. But this is also most of the book, probably half the book is set in Afghanistan. I haven't counted the pages.
You're right,
But you take us to places that you yourself experienced after your family left Afghanistan.
Yeah, and the story begins in a village and just keeps expanding outward. Mm. It goes to Kabul, and then from there it kind of goes to Europe, France, and even Greece, and then expands outward to the United States, and the cast of characters gets larger as well. It was kind of nice to write a book where the story world didn't simply begin with Kabul and end with Kandahar. I mean, Afghanistan is the home base, but I did want to expand sort of the cultural, the social surroundings and my characters a bit. And I have lived in France and been to Greece, and I, you know, obviously I've lived in the U.S. the last 32 years, so I felt fairly comfortable writing about those places.
We're talking with writer Khaled Hosseini. His new book is called And the Mountains Echoed. And you were a preteen or early teenager when you left Afghanistan?
Yeah, I was 11 years old when I left, went to Paris, and moved to the U.S. when I was 15.
And you spoke no English when you came to the United States?
No, English is actually my third language, because I began speaking Farsi, learned French in France, and became fluent. And I learned English really when I came to the States.
It's interesting that you write in English.
Yes.
Do you ever think about writing in Farsi or French?
I could write in either one of those two languages, I suppose, but I have now developed a narrative voice in my head, and there's a particular now familiar rhythm with which I write, and a sort of a tempo and a flow and a particular voice in my head that I now recognize as my own. I don't have that voice in Farsi or French. I suppose technically what I write would be grammatically correct, but there wouldn't be any sort of style of flair that I would recognize as my own.
Do you feel most comfortable in English?
Very much. Writing, very, very much. Yeah.
There are a set of characters. This story comes to California, where you essentially grew up and
yes.
where I believe your family still lives,
yes.
you and your family. And it's interesting to think about that immigrant experience. Refugees are part of this book, but mm-hmm. It's different to be a refugee, I think, the way your family was refugees to California, or as opposed to the refugees who end up over the Pakistani border. Mm-hmm. And those people are in this book as well, both kinds of refugees.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose under the big umbrella, these are both groups of people who've been uprooted and have lost their communities, but they have vastly different experiences. I came to the United States, like a few of these characters here, as sort of political asylum seekers, and we were resettled in the United States and had, you know, sort of the struggles of immigrant families, that you know, the assimilation and restarting life in a new culture and learning the language and so on and so forth. But those, you know, quote unquote struggles paled in comparison to those of refugees. You know, these people who Afghans who fled across the border because they fled persecution, war, and violence, and they settled in refugee camps under very, you know, difficult conditions in neighboring countries.
When did you first see those camps?
In the 80s, you know, and that's when sort of the Afghan refugee crisis became a massive humanitarian issue. And at one point, at the height of the crisis, it was 8 million Afghans who were, refugees, the largest refugee population in the world. So I watched that from afar. And when in 2006, the UN Refugee Agency, which is the UN office charged with safeguarding and protecting the rights of refugees, contacting me to be a spokesperson for them, it just felt like such a natural fit and something I felt passionate about.
You are an envoy for them. What does that entail?
It entails educating myself. I have focused primarily on Afghan refugees, educating myself on the challenges of both refugees, but increasingly returning refugees, the people who have returned to Afghanistan, as millions have since the fall of the Taliban in 2001, understanding what the challenges are to reintegrate in a country where there's little central government and raising awareness in the West about those issues.
Now, that story finds its way into this
yes.
book. The book, the Afghan portions of this book are set either in Kabul or in this village. I'm not sure if it's a real village.
A fictional village.
And there is, which is where you start the book, which is where the family with the wagon is from. Maybe you want to talk about that scene. There's a warlord who's come mm-hmm. back and essentially built himself a mega palace, as I interpret it, a gaudy mega palace.
Yes.
And he's installed his wife and his son inside the walls of the
yeah, place. The chapter is told through the eyes of the boy who worships his father. And his father is a very sort of caring, father who really is tender with his son, really is very attentive to him. And the boy is living sort of, he's alone, he's kind of bored, but he lives in this palace in the middle of nowhere in Afghanistan, this big gaudy thing with towers and turrets and the reflecting glass windows, and you know, he has bodyguards. And so he has sort of this very insular view of the world. What he doesn't really understand, although he eventually comes to understand, is that his father has a very complicated nature and sort of leads a dual life. It's like he's kind, and he can be benevolent, but he's also, you know, a thug. And it turns out that the land on which they're living belongs to somebody else, and those people come back and want to get it back. And, you know, that...
They come back and they're totally impoverished. They have nothing. And I'm assuming that that's often the case for folks who are coming back from these camps.
Yeah. And the people who do come back, you know, that this boy gets to know are a family of Afghan refugees who have lived in Pakistan for a couple of decades and now have come back to Afghanistan because Pakistan is closing down a lot of refugee camps. And also the Taliban have left and they see it as a chance to restart life in their own country. And there's something I saw over and over again in Afghanistan is you have these entire families that come back, want to resettle on their old lands. Unfortunately, land land disputes have become such a big issue in Afghanistan. Ownership is completely muddled. They come back and there's somebody squatting on their property. They've destroyed their home and built their own house. And so these people essentially end up homeless and landless on their own property.
The other thing that this brought up was sort of, besides the class differentiation, was the two kinds of moneyed classes. Earlier in the book, I may have the order out of order, we meet a sort of old money cobble gentleman and his wife, and there's reasons that they're married. It's not a happy marriage. She's a poet, an artist, and he's sort of a gentleman, and people can read the book to find out a little bit more. But this is sort of like a traditional... Western-facing group of elites, as opposed to warlord elites.
Yeah, that group of elites is quite vivid from my own recollections of living in Kabul in that time and place. I mean, the couple that we meet early in the book, and they're very closely linked to the children at the beginning of the book, and especially the wife, the poet, ends up playing a very pivotal role in the life of the two children, especially the little girl. But those are the kinds of people I remembered from Kabul growing up. I mean, there was a certain crust of Kabul society that had become increasingly westernized, so to say, had been influenced by Western music and films and culture and food and so on. Mm-hmm. And I suppose my family kind of belonged to that crust. And I saw a lot of people like this, the Wahdatis, this couple that we meet early in the book. This new class of the appallingly wealthy is an altogether different beast. And these are folks that have benefited, frankly, from the struggles of the country,
right,
and have become almost unbelievably wealthy, often at the cost of the little guys. And so this guy, for instance, is, you know, apparently he's an opium trafficker,
right,
who's made a lot of money, you know, trafficking drugs. But, you know, it's interesting because this is something else that I saw and heard in Afghanistan, is that these sort of all-powerful warlords are feared. They're intimidating. They're sort of these kind of semi-dictators. And yet, at the same time, there is some reluctant degree of admiration for them because some of them have taken on kind of philanthropic roles.
As has your character.
Yeah, I mean, here's a guy who's essentially responsible for the genesis of this town. You know, he's the one who gives loans to people that he doesn't bother recollecting so that people can start businesses. He builds a school for girls. He builds a clinic for women hires a midwife and a doctor. So in some way, you know, he likes to think himself in that famous line from Lawrence of Arabia that he's a river to his own people. Mm-hmm. But of course, he's also a scary guy.
Well, what it also brought up for me was a question of the real world, the non-novel part of the story. Does that Western-facing class exist still? And what role do the sort of outlaw warlords play in power structure, the governmental power structure, and rebuilding the country as it tries to move forward.
Well, I think the old sort of the couple early in my book, well, that class of people, they've left and they have resettled elsewhere and they're being phased out. But there is, I think, a new class of sort of Western thinking Afghans rising, and these are the youth. And I think that the reason these are the urban professional young Afghans, and the way they're becoming increasingly sort of connected with the outside world is through technology, through the internet, through the airwaves. There, I think that may be ultimately, you know, the secret salvation of Afghanistan. I think is the increasingly progressive thinking of an increasingly large youthful population. You know, 60% of the country is under the age of 20.
Wow.
So they I think will be the agent of change in Afghanistan. The warlords and sort of these old militias have more or less become assimilated into political parties for some of them, and are part of the sort of the political arena in Afghanistan. I guess the real question is whether they'll remain political parties going forth, or whether they will revert back to, you know, their fighting ways once the U.S. troops leave. And that's a big question.
We're talking with writer Khaled Hosseini. His new book is And the Mountains Echoed. There's another, it's not a wedge, but there's another layer to all this as Afghanistan moves forward. And this is the sort of relief worker level. Mm-hmm. And in this book, we meet two cousins. I believe they're cousins. They're American. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of them is a physician. The other is kind of a gaudy, flashy guy. And
they're Afghan-Americans.
They're Afghan-Americans. They come back and they find themselves in a pool. Well, the physician does, a pool of relief workers, and mm-hmm. And an encounter with a little girl who has been
brutally injured.
Yeah, I was going to say traumatically injured, and he's struggling with how to help her. This, I understand, comes out of your own. I mean, you are trained as a physician. I'm not sure if you practice medicine. You probably don't have time to practice medicine anymore, but you actually did come back and participate in this sort of relief effort.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, that chapter in the book, it takes place in 2003, which is the exact time when I went back. Mm. And I was a fully practicing physician at that time. I am no longer. But I do remember very much this character's sense of helplessness and his being overwhelmed by the enormous scale of human suffering that he's witnessing virtually at every street corner. I have a dear friend who works for the UN Refugee Agency who had this phrase that he would say, you know, Kabul is, or the country is, Afghanistan is 1,000 tragedies per square mile. And mm-hmm. that's what he experiences. And it's really shocking. And he, it sort of sparks a kind of philanthropic impulse, dormant impulse in him, and he becomes almost intoxicated with this sudden energy to help people and to rescue this little girl. And what he ends up finding out is that that generosity and kindness and that sort of undertaking is quite laborious, and it's complicated, and it's labor-intensive, and it's difficult. And he learns a powerful lesson about the measures of his own, you know, abilities.
It's also interesting what it reveals structurally. We've been talking about the sort of chaos of decades of war and layers of changing leadership and various occupying forces, I guess, for lack of a better term. And so this is 10 years ago that you saw this. How is it different in Afghanistan in 2013?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I think, I don't think I need to enumerate Afghanistan's problems because they're so well documented, you know, between the lack of effective governance throughout the country to, you know, the stubborn nature of the insurgent groups, to drug trafficking, the lack of transparency in many branches of the government, rampant poverty, and a sort of an uncertain future politically in Afghanistan. So those have been well documented. But at the same time, it is a mixed bag because there are also some positive things that I've seen every time I go to Afghanistan. Mm. Every time I go to Kabul, I notice there's a lot more electricity. You know, there's a lot more roads built. Millions of kids have returned to school And that's not something to be disregarded. And when the Taliban were in power, there were under 1 million children in this country in school. Now there's over 8 million, and almost 3 million are girls. Life expectancy has increased dramatically in Afghanistan. It hovered around 40 for decades, and it's now close to 60. Been really dramatic improvements in the field of healthcare and so on. So it's a mixed bag, and you know, the positive changes that have happened haven't gone as far and as deep as we would like, and haven't reached as many people as we would like, but they could potentially serve as a foundation moving forward. But I think I'm, like many Afghans, quite anxious, nervous about the immediate future of the country as this sort of transition period looms.
What do you foresee? And one of the things, I'm talking to you on the day that Staff Sergeant Bales is going to admit guilt for 16 murders of Afghan civilians, mostly women and children. Some of the survivors have said that they vow retaliation to kill 100 Americans for this. And it leads me to wonder about the relationship of the average Afghan to the American forces there, or to Americans who aren't even there? I mean, what do people think about America leaving, staying?
Well, look, they have a complicated relationship. It's a fairly nuanced, because, you know, there has been sort of this early on, the support for the troops was fairly strong. Mm. I mean, the polls demonstrated that. That kind of eroded to some extent over the years because of a series of things that happened, airstrikes, wedding parties that were mistakenly shot, night raids, acts of cultural insensitivity, like, you know, flushing Qurans and urinating on bodies of dead people. And the Sergeant Bales massacre was a horrible, you know, catastrophe. And couple that with very effective propaganda on the part of the Taliban, who really kind of co-opted the grievances the legitimate grievances that people had. And that led to some degree of erosion. Significant, I think. That said, you know, there is still kind of, if you walk the streets of Kabul, if you go out and you talk to people, and that has been my experience, that they nevertheless see the presence of the NATO and U.S. troops as a safeguard against the one thing that they truly fear, and that is a return to the militia wars of the 1990s. And that, as far as the Afghan perspective, is the scenario that they want to avoid at all cost. And, you know, there's no tradition for Afghans liking the presence of foreign troops on their soil, quite the opposite. But it goes to show you the degree to which they're concerned about that scenario, that these folks, of all people, would begrudgingly at least support the presence of these troops.
Well, it seems that just partly geographically, Afghanistan is in a crossroads where first it was Soviet troops when there was the Soviet Union. So it's been 50-some years, and more than that, that people have crossed across this country.
Centuries.
And
yeah.
So that there always seems to be some foreign presence asserting its rights or its power.
And that's sort of the part of the Afghan DNA. It's sort of this aversion to the, you know, the foreign master, you know, and there's a long tradition of resisting that. And again, you know, I think it speaks volumes that I'm not saying Afghans are happy that there are troops there, but they do see it as a safeguard against against this kind of, you know, unraveling into civil war again.
How often do you go back?
Well, I've been back. The last time I was there was in September of 2010, and I've been back, I think, I guess it would be four times since 2003.
It's been a long time since you lived in that country permanently. Yeah. Do you still think of yourself as Afghan? Are you Afghan-American? Are you American?
I don't think about it too much unless I'm asked, I suppose. there's a core inside me that is very much tied to my Afghan roots, to the fact that I spent my formative years in Afghanistan. I was born and raised there, that I speak the language, and I have a very, you know, a strong emotional connection to the country. At the same time, you know, I've lived now in the States for 32 years, and it's become my home. I have a lot of roots in the U.S. So I have sort of this, what they call it, sort of this hyphenated existence, and I don't think too much about it. I just live my life, but I do feel enriched by my Afghan heritage, and Afghanistan occupies a big space in my life.
And we see that this is the first of the three novels that you've written that really spends as much time out of the country as mm-hmm. in the country, and it's less a story of this the history of Afghanistan mm-hmm. and more the story of people.
Yeah, I think in some ways, strangely enough, it's the most accessible of the three books because it's really about human experiences that are very universal. It's really about intimate human dramas. It's, you know, it's about love and family, friendship, wanting to belong to something. It's far less, I think, to some extent, Afghan-centric than the other books. I mean, the heart of the book is still in Afghanistan, but what happens in Afghanistan, the wars, the Taliban, and all the things that have unfolded there aren't as immediate and pressing an influence on the lives of these characters as in the previous two.
Do you ever imagine writing a book that never goes to Afghanistan?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's all about story and character for me, and not that much about setting. Yeah, I would like that very much.
Have you started that book yet?
No, I haven't started anything yet. I'm trying to finish this book tour.
And as we drag you through here, A Thousand Splendid Sons is going to be a film as well, yes?
I don't know. It's, you know, it's in limbo for the time being. There's no new developments yet.
But that we could see that as we saw The Kite Runner.
Potentially.
Honestly, Khaled Hosseini's new novel is called And the Mountains Echoed, and he's going to be talking tonight at 7 at University Bookstore on the Ave in Seattle. Look forward to seeing you then.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for coming in. This is Weekday on KUOW. And now, the sound of the day.
That's not the sound of the day, Marcy. That's the sound of yesterday.
Yeah, I think those are the little pigs.
Let's try this one. Well, we're still in the barnyard.
We are indeed, but this doesn't sound like slop. This is a chicken, or a hen, I guess, called Sophia, a Dominique chicken, and she is about to lay an egg, according to Susie and Steve, who live in Seattle Central District. Apparently, Sophia makes quite a to-do about laying, but her eggs are worth it. I like that. You just imagine her. I mean, it's a little more feminine than the pigs and the slop yesterday.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit. Well,
she's hard at work.
She is hard at work. So, you know, you don't have to send us sounds of barnyard animals, but we like them. We're interested in what you're listening to in the world around you. So we're hoping that you'll record 30 seconds of what you hear and send that sound to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email the audio file to weekday@kuow.org and please include sound of the day in the subject line. Sounds of the next hour, some of the worst sci-fi movies ever. I know. You start making that list now. Also, Vaughn Palmer with news from Canada, and we're going to talk business with John Talton, and specifically we're going to talk about China in the world and how it's kind of using its economic might. So you're going to want to listen.
Indeed. It all starts right after this hour's news, just a couple minutes from now. 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Regional Heart Center, where patients from the Puget Sound area and throughout the Pacific Northwest region receive multidisciplinary comprehensive cardiovascular care. More information at uwmedicine.org.
In case you missed it, librarian Nancy Pearl was here Monday talking about biographies. Nancy recommended a bunch of biographies, and listeners recommended biographies as well. We've put together a list of all the titles that were mentioned, a couple dozen, including Gertrude Bell, Queen of the Desert by Georgina Howell, and Einstein, His Life and Universe by Walter Isaacson. You can find the entire list of recommended biographies at kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting Benjamin Britten's War Requiem on June 13th and 15th, conducted by Ludovic Morlot and featuring two orchestras, three vocal soloists, and three choirs. Tickets and information by calling the box office or online at seattlesymphony.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.